First of all, welcome everyone. Special thank you to Danielle who put this whole thing together. And really, and if anyone else has any more ideas of how to bring more Torah or any other exciting things to America, just let me know. Okay, so there are two things that I want to begin with before we sort of properly get into Eob, and that is as follows. That number one, so I think we have like 7 or 8 classes scheduled from now until the end of the summer. We're going away for about a week and a half in the middle there, and then with like other things going on, it's about 8 classes until like mid-August. So the goal is obviously not to read through all of Eob in the text in this class, because it's just not going to be possible to read through all of it. There are 42 prakim in Eob. Now what that means is that it's somewhat long. It happens to be that the prakim are not that long, right? When people think of a parak, it sounds like kind of intimidating, because when you think of, like, as far as the Torah, right, the Torah has a pretty long prakim a lot of times. Most of the prakim are, like, on average 10 to 15 psukim in Eob, so it's not so crazy, but it is pretty sizable, so we won't read through the entire text. What we will do is we'll read through sort of some of the main parts, and then we'll sort of skim through and give more general thematic ideas throughout other parts, and we'll see in a second for source number one when we go through the general outline of the book. You'll see why that actually does make a lot of sense when you learn Eob in a context like this. The other sort of pre-announcement to this class is to say why we're actually doing Eob now. And that is because we're coming upon the 3 weeks, right? Tammuz is going to begin soon, and then we'll have Shavasar B'Tammuz, and then Tisha B'Av, and then the whole three-week period in between. And obviously, we know that the three-week period is a time of sadness and mourning, and one of the books that we like to learn during this time period is Sefer Eob, because of its
moving on. Absolutely.
So the question I want to throw out before we do formally begin is, if we were to sort of go around the table, and don't feel free not to participate, but this is sort of I would like participation, I don't like just talking straight. So if I were to ask you what Eob is all about, and what the story is about, who the person was, what sort of answers would you give me?
I don't know, I've never heard of this before.
okay, good.
We were just talking about this, it's like one of the really rare, not well known books.
Right, okay, good. So fantastic. So one of the really important things that you need to know about Eob, if you did not know already because you never heard of Eob, is that most of the books of Tanakh that we have are read through at some point throughout the year, right? Obviously, the whole Torah is read. Many of the books of Tanakh, if not of a Nevi'im, are read, if not in entirety, at some point parts of it are read because of the Haftorah. And then, of course, we have the Megillos that we read at various points throughout the year. Now, there are a few books of Ksuvim that don't really ever get read at all. So that's Eov, Daniel, Mishlei. Tehillim is not ever formally read, but everyone knows Tehillim. So Eob is sort of like one of those books that no one really does know about unless they have the opportunity to learn it in a context like this. Okay, so great. So some people have never heard of it beforehand, before this class. What else do we know about Eob?
We don't really know if that person existed, or if it was just like a parable, kind of like Mishlei.
Okay, great. So some people say, as we'll see, that Eob never existed, and that the ramifications of that will be fascinating for us. And the other thoughts or suggestions of what Eob, who he was. Okay, great. So let's jump right in. Yes.
Just a quick question: is Eob one of the things that we're allowed to learn on Tisha B'Av?
Yeah,
it is.
Yeah, because it's such a sad book. Mm-hmm. Yeah, and God willing, we'll see just how sad it is.
Because that's also
also meaningful. Well, but
I mean, like, I feel like it's, you're like, we're gonna learn a really sad book now.
He didn't write Eichel? Who wrote
Eichel? So probably Yirmiyahu wrote it.
So it's interesting, I'm just thinking about it now. You know, we probably all heard that it's okay to learn Eov on Tisha B'Av, but how many people do you know that actually do learn Eov on Tisha B'Av? I don't think I've ever, and I've been in some pretty large shuls, and I never see anyone advertising, oh, we're learning Eov.
Right.
At what time period is Eov?
Ah, fantastic question. We'll see. It's a little unclear. Okay, but great question. Okay.
It's like during the Nevi'im time. Maybe?
We'll see. We'll get there. Okay, so take a look at source number one. So source number one is just an outline that I found online. It's actually a pretty good outline. I'm going to tell you the outline of the book, just Baal-Peh, without looking inside, but feel free to look at this outline as like a basic guide. The basic outline of the book is as follows. You have the first two prakim, which sort of serve as this introduction of who Eob was and his life story. And it basically says that he, and we'll see it inside, that he was great, everything was going well in his life, he was a servant of God, but then everything fell apart and he decided to go away from God. Perek Gimel is the beginning of a major conversation. Most of Iyov is just a conversation between himself and his three friends, and then a few other people sort of chime in. But for the most part, most of the book is a conversation from Perek Gimel all the way until Perek Mem Aleph. It's just a conversation of back and forth. Perek Gimel does begin with sort of like this monologue, if you will. It's actually not a monologue. It's Iyov actually sort of exclaiming the following to his friends, and that is how depressed he is and how much he doesn't like God, how much he blames God, how sad he is that he is still alive in this world. And then you have sort of like these rounds of debates that we'll read through to some extent, that his friends sort of each take a shot at trying to say, Iyov, it's true that your life is really bad right now, but don't worry, things will get better. And they sort of each take turns. Each of them speak around 2 to 3 times, depending on the person. And then towards the end of the book, a new character comes in, who we'll see who that is when we get there. Then God gives a big speech, and then finally, the last parak, chapter 42, parak Mem Beis, Iyov sort of gets over all this, and things go back to being good in his life, and he ends up doing a complete 360 and ending up back where he began, and that is up on top, and now he trusts in God and believes in God once again. So we're going to go through the entire book sort of systematically, following that basic guide. That is, the more story-esque parts will sort of do more in depth. The more conversational parts we'll look at more just as general themes and not actually go into the entire text. Okay, so let's begin reading. Let's everyone open up their EO. Okay, so from the very first pasuk of Iyov, there are all these questions that sort of just pop in. So let's take a look. So the pasuk reads as follows: Ishaya ve'eretz Utz, Iyov Shemo. There was a man who lived in the land of Utz, and his name was Iyov. Ve'haya ha'ish ha'hu tam v'yashar v'yirei Elokim v'sar meira. And he was a really great man. He was a wholesome individual who was an upright person, a fearer of God, and he would always turn away from evil. So there are a few general questions that you have to ask. One of those questions is the one that Danielle asks, and that is, what time period is Iyov living in? If you look at this first pasuk, what time period is he living in?
I'm sure you can guess from the land of Oz.
Who's? It's like Wizard of Oz living there. Okay, so great. So from the first pasuk, we have no clue. It's very unclear. And nowhere else in the entire Sefer does it seem to indicate what time period he lives in. So that's the first question. When exactly is he living in? Question number two, who was Iyov? Right? Usually we'll introduce someone by giving some characteristics of who they are based on who his father was, or he has an important sibling, or these are the important events that he did in his life. Here we have no idea who this guy is. We just know that there is a man named Iyov. Okay, third question, where is he from?
Utz.
Yeah, land of Utz. Where is the land of Utz?
Yeah.
I don't know, I never heard of it. Anyone here ever heard of Utz? Okay, so it's unclear exactly what Utz is. And then finally, as was raised before as well, sort of a parenthetical question to really get to the root of these three questions, and that is, who wrote Sefer Iyov?
We're going to have to sort of try and figure out who wrote it. So, says the Gemara in Bava Basra in source number 2, Moshe Kasav Sifro Uparshas Bilam V'Iyov. So Moshe authored 3 books. One was Sifro. Right, Sifro is the Torah, his book. Parshas Bilam, the Parsha of Balak. It's a little bit complicated that this should be included as a second thing that he wrote. That should, seemingly is part of the Torah. The answer probably is that it's extraneous to what the story that the Torah is telling. So therefore, it's listed as a second thing. And finally, Iyov, he wrote the book of Job. He wrote the book.
So the Gemara continues, Misayele l'Rebbe Levi bar l'chama, the Amar Rebbe Levi bar l'chama, Iyov bimei Moshe haya. So just like Danielle said, the reason why Moshe was the one who wrote the book was because Iyov was living in the time of Moshe. So it was a natural fit. The ima bimei Yitzchak. However, there's another opinion that says that Iyov actually lived in the time of Yitzchak Avinu, and seemingly therefore maybe someone else might have written it. It's a little unclear what the Gemara means, if it means just that he lived in the time of Yitzchak, or if it's suggesting that there was another author as well. The ima bimei Yaakov. There's another opinion that says that it was written that he lived in the times of Yaakov. There's an opinion that says he was living in the times of Yosef. Rav Amar Iyov Bimei Meraglim. Hiya, what's weird about suggesting that Iyov lived in the times of the Meraglim?
That's Moshe.
Right, because that's the same time as Moshe Rabbeinu. So you already begin to get a certain sense of the fact that when they're suggesting that Iyov would have lived during the time period of these various groups or these various people, it seems like there's a deeper implication there, as if Iyov was more associated with them. So it's true, he might have lived in the time of Yitzchak, and the reason why that's important is because maybe Iyov and Yitzchak were friends. Okay, could be he lived in the time of Moshe, maybe he was close with Moshe. Or he lived in the time of the Meraglim because he was associated more with the Meraglim. That would sort of give you more of a background of who he was.
Going back to the ish that we were talking about before, it could be these are all true. This person who is nameless, but is the person kind of in the periphery of the Torah in every situation, and and I don't know yet who the people are that have these arguments that we mentioned in the outline, are all these great people who were trying to, you know, help the person out throughout.
Could be. Interesting.
Is there a translation for you?
Other than Arnsman?
Yeah, besides your Job.
Oh, no. You're saying translate the actual name?
Yeah, the name.
As far as I know, I think it's just Job, and it's just a transliteration of the Hebrew to English.
The name doesn't mean anything.
I haven't seen anything. It could be. I could look into that. I'm not sure. Okay. Interesting. Let me look into it. I'm not sure. Okay. So keep going. So the Gemara brings a proof for why you would have said any of these suggestions, but I thought this one was just sort of telling. Hayaksev Hacha, it says over here, Ish Hayab Eretz Utz Iyov Shemo, right? So we know we read that pasuk, that's the first pasuk of Iyov, and he was from the land of Utz. Viksiv Hasam, and it says with regards to the Meraglim, Hayesh Ba Eitz, that there are trees. And so therefore, this person said that it must be that Iyov is in the times of the Meraglim, and that's why he's from the land of Utz, not that he's actually from this place called Utz. That doesn't make any sense. We don't know what Utz is. Rather, he's a place that has trees, and just like trees are mentioned with the Meraglim, so too Iyov was part of that time period. A little bit of a stretch, it would seem, but that's what he says. Yasev Ahu Merabanan Kamed Rabbi Shmuel Bar Nachmani V'Yasev V'Kamar Iyov Lo Hayav Lo Nivra. This is what Menachem said. There's another opinion. There's a suggestion that says that maybe Iyov never existed. The Rambam was a proponent of this. He said that it doesn't make any sense. He looked at the book. It's a bit of an odd book. It must be that it never actually existed. It's just here Ella Mashal. It's here to give us as a parable, a certain lesson, but this guy never actually existed. Hayah Amar Le Alecha Amar Kra Ish Hayah Be'eretz Utz Iyov Shemo. The argument back that is what he is saying. What are you talking about? The book says there was a guy named Iyov. It'd be one thing if the book said, you know, there was once a tale of a story, you know, that happened. But that's not what it says. There was a guy named Iyov that lived once. And in the end of the book, it says how many years Iyov lived after this whole story. So the notion to say that he didn't exist is very hard to sort of mesh with the text. Again, the Rambam has no issue with these things. He says what he says, and he has the right to say whatever he wants to say usually. But again, to argue it, it seems a little bit difficult. Going further, Rabbi Yochanan v'Rabbi Elazar, de Amri Tervayu, Iyov me'ole gola haya. Who was Iyov? He was actually one of the people who came back to the land of Israel after the first exile. He came back. Ubei medrashu b'Tveria haya. Actually, it was so interesting. He had a base medrash in Tveria. So he went from thinking that maybe Moshe Rabbeinu wrote it to one of the Avos, that he was living in the times of the Avos, all the way to thinking that maybe he was living in the times of the return back to the land of Israel, and maybe he had a base medrash in this place called Tveria. What's so interesting about Tveria? Who else lived in Tveria? who was the one who said this statement?
Rabbi Yochanan.
Where did Rabbi Yochanan live? He lived in Tveria. A little bit odd. We'll see if there is any deeper meaning to that in a second. Meisvei Yimeshon Asav Shel Iyov Mishash and Nichnasu Yisrael Mitzrayim Biyashayatsu. There is an opinion that says that his years were not in the times of the second, going back to the land of Israel, but rather he lived during the time of when the Jewish people came in to Mitzrayim and up until the time they left Mitzrayim. Ima kemasa shenichnasu Yisrael Mitzrayim v'ad shashayatsu. Another opinion says no, he didn't live during that time period. He actually lived for the amount of years that time period was, the entire time of the enslavement in Egypt. That's how many years he actually lived. Another opinion, another opinion says that, by the way, this guy Iyov, he wasn't even Jewish, right? So that's another important idea that we need to sort of grapple with. It's odd to say that we have an entire book written in our Tanakh, in our Holy Tanakh, about someone who isn't Jewish at all, right? The only time we really ever have a situation like that explicitly, where there's a specific passage associated with someone who isn't Jewish and has nothing to do with the Jewish people, is obviously Bilam and Balak, right? But otherwise, for the most part, we generally assume, obviously, there are non-Jewish characters that come up. They're enemies, perhaps, of the Jewish people. But if you're telling a story of someone who's significantly important, and of course, setting aside
entire book for someone, you would like to assume that he's Jewish. But okay, this opinion in the Gemara says that he actually was not Jewish. Yes, but
sir.
Sorry?
Yes, sir.
Okay, good. So the Parsha, right, the Parsha is named after him, but even so, he converted, right?
And,
right. Nonetheless, there is a lot to say that he was
very
certainly...
There are a few cases where this...
Right, exactly. And certainly none as extreme as Eov would be,
right.
And not even as extreme as Bilam and Balak would be, that there is a whole Parsha dedicated to that. So, okay, there's one opinion that says that he was one of the righteous non-Jews of the world. Eov Yimei Shvot HaShoftim. Another opinion says that he lived during the times of the judges, during when Sefer Shoftim was written. Rabbi Yishuv ben Karchomer, Eov Yimei Achashverosh. Another opinion says that no, he lived during the times of the Purim story. Ve'ima Bimei David, like Daniel said, maybe he was living in the times of David. Rabbi Nasan Omer, Eov Yimei Malchus Sheba Haya, maybe he was living during the times of the Queen of Sheba. Okay. Maybe he was living in the times of the Chaldeans. And the final opinion says that maybe he was living in the times of Yaakov Avinu. And why? Well, fascinatingly, Vedina Bas Yaakov Nasa, that he was married to, who we'll see that Eov's wife comes up once in the entire Sefer, that's in Perek Beis, which we'll speak about next week, and everyone wants to know who he was married to, who his wife, who this mysterious woman was, who was seemingly trying to lead him away from God, as we'll see inside, and some people say that was actually Dina, Yaakov's daughter, and now how do we grapple with the fact that she was trying to lead him away from God? We'll have to worry about that next week, but there are people who say that he must have been living in the times of Yaakov, because he was married to Yaakov's daughter. Now, what do we do with all of these possibilities to say that there is a million different possibilities? I didn't take an actual account, but maybe it's like 15 or 16 possible time periods that he might have lived in. So first of all, let's just state the obvious. It could be, right? We know that in the times of Tanakh, there were people who lived several hundred years. So it's not so crazy to say that, he was born in the times of Avraham Avinu, and he could have lived all the way, for, 800 years. And that would take him pretty far into many of these people that were named over here. So it could be that he did live during a significant amount of time that overlapped with many of these people's lives. What you would like to probably see, though, is that there is a deeper significance to the fact that why is he associated to each and every one of these people, and why would someone assume that he would be in the times of Yitzchak, or maybe he'd be in the time of Moshe? Is there something that they're trying to associate? And to go back to what we said before, that the suggestion that Eov was living in Tveria, that he had a base medicine in Tveria, and Rabbi Yochanan was the one who made that suggestion, and the fact that Rabbi Yochanan was living in Tveria himself, and he had a base medicine in Tveria, you begin to sort of see this formula for deciding where Eov lived, not based on a necessary reality, but more on a certain assumption of what the story of Eov is all about. And that is that if the story of Eov, whether or not it happened, is irrelevant. Even if it did happen, the point, our takeaway, is ultimately to try to apply it to our lives. And therefore, you can argue that potentially the authors of Eov, or the author of Eov rather, was so vague because his actual life is totally irrelevant to us. Who he was, where he lived, it's totally not important for us. Rather, we have to be able to apply it to our own lives. And maybe Rabbi Yochanan, he was taking that lesson and showing us and teaching us that lesson, saying that, who was Eov? Where was he from? Utz? Where is Utz? I don't know. I don't care. That's not important. But you have to know about Eov that we, each of us, can see our lives in Eov at various periods in our life. We can see the experiences that Eov went through and we can apply them to ourselves. And in particular, the reason why there's an interesting link between Rabbi Yochanan and Eov, anyone have any suggestions? What do we know about the life of Rabbi Yochanan? Anything? Take a look at source number 3. It's the Gemara in Brachos. V'ha'amar Rabbi Yochanan din garma da'asira'a bir. Rabbi Yochanan used to walk around with the 10th bone of his son. Rabbi Yochanan was famous for a lot of things, but one of the things he was known for was the fact that he lost 10 sons in his lifetime. Who else lost 10 children in their lifetime? Yeah, Eov lost 10 children, right? Yeah. Mm-hmm. Right, take a look at Pasuk Beis in Eov. V'yevaldu lo shiva vanim v'shalosh banos. He had 7 sons and 3 daughters, and we'll see what exactly comes of all these children. But the fact that he had 10 children, and he had a terrible life, and the fact that Rabbi Yochanan had 10 children, and he lost all of them, and the fact that Rabbi Yochanan says that he was living in Tveria, it seems like what Rabbi Yochanan is trying to do is link Eov's life to him. And when he's answering the question of where and when did Eov live, Rabbi Yochanan is telling us it doesn't make a difference when he lived or where he lived. All you have to know is that his life can be found in all of our lives. Good? Okay.
That wasn't the only bad thing in the book. Actually, there's Lakish, the whole story.
Yeah, he had a lot of things they struggled with, but
so it seems like he's referring to himself.
Yeah. Very good. Yeah.
It's like so crazy that Eov lost 10 sons, and then Rabbi Yochanan also just lost 10 sons.
Yeah, it's kind of crazy. Okay, now the question might be that on the one hand, that's a really nice link to say that Rabbi Yochanan thought that Eov was like him, and therefore he said that Eov lived in his hometown, or not his hometown, but the place that he lived in. So that's a nice link, but is there anyone else that could be linked to that extent to Eov? And so maybe you can suggest that Moshe can also be linked to such an extent, right? What types of things did Moshe experience in his lifetime that he would be connected to Eov?
Slavery.
On the one hand, you can say that Moshe saw terrible things in his lifetime, and of course that was the fact that Jews were enslaved, right? It's interesting that the enslavement of the Jewish people is never sort of compared to the Holocaust, right? And the reason why is seemingly because the enslavement was thousands of years ago and the Holocaust happened in our time period. But when you think about the effects of the fact that the Jewish people went in as a just a small family, and they grew into this incredible nation, and then that entire nation was basically destroyed, right? The famous Medrash that talks about the fact that only 1/5 of the Jewish people left Mitzrayim, right? We know in the times of the Holocaust we lost 1/3 of the Jewish people, but in the times of the enslavement of the Jewish people, when they left, they lost 4/5 of the Jewish people. The numbers seemingly were a little bit smaller then, but the effect is still clear that there was a terrible tragedy that happened then. And the fact that you might want to question that there is a God in the world is not such a crazy concept. How could God do such a thing to an entire nation? What other things might Moshe have experienced that would say that that would link him to Eov?
A punishment. He couldn't go into the land.
Okay, maybe. Anything else?
I don't know what happened to
you. Okay, good. Fine. Fair enough. Take a look at source number 4. Perhaps this Gemara will give us a link into Moshe's life to see a proof as to why Moshe would have been one of the authors of Sefer Eov. Says the Gemara, we'll read it in English, in Gemara in Brachos. Moshe said before God, Master of the Universe, why is it that the righteous prosper, the righteous suffer, the wicked prosper, and the wicked suffer? Right? You have four types of people in this world. You have righteous people who do good and do bad. You have wicked people who do good and do bad. And why is it that you have these types of people? How do you explain all that, right? The famous sugi of Tzadik or Alo, how can it be you have a good person, but bad things happen to him? That was Moshe's question to God. So the Gemara has a lengthy conversation about this. I quoted part of it here, and the first part of this conversation is God attempting to give an answer to Moshe. But what you have to wonder is, why is it that Moshe had to ask this question in the first place? Right? What was really going through his mind that he wanted to ask this question? And it seems like the answer is that he had experienced tragedy in his lifetime. So whether that be the enslavement or of the Jewish people, or seeing the life of Eov himself, right? Both of those could be possibilities as to why Moshe was really struggling of how bad things could happen to good people, because bad things happened to Eov, and of course Eov was a really great person. Now, one other, probably more well-known proof as to why you would say that Eov was living in the time of Moshe is what? What do we know about Eov? There's one thing that, like, I think everyone knows about Eov, and the second I say it, you'll know what I'm talking about. Which other characters do we see associated with Eov in various Midrashim or Gemaras or things like that? Take a look at source number 5. Gemara in Sota. Yud Aleph and Aleph. B'chi Bar Abba says that Rabbi Simai says, 3 noteworthy people were consulted by Paro in the council, where Paro questioned what should be done with the Jewish people. They were Bilam, Eov, and Yisro. Rabbi Chiya bar Abba teaches what occurred to each of them. Bilam, who advised Paro to kill all the sons born to the Jewish people, was punished by being killed in the war with Midian. Eov, who was silent and neither advised nor protested, was punished by suffering, as detailed in the book of Eov. Yisro, who ran away as a sign of protest, merited that some of his children's children sat in the Sanhedrin in the chamber of hewn stone. So what we see from here, from this Gemara in and of itself, is that clearly Eov was living in the times of Moshe, and therefore arguably the Moshe could have known Eov, and Moshe would be one of the people who would be expected to write the book of Eov, because he had a relationship with him, or he saw him. How did he see him? How did he interact with him? Because he was a guy who was a Ben Bias in Paro's house, and Moshe was always in Paro's house. He grew up in Paro's house. That's one. Two, even when he left Paro's house, he came back to try to take the Jewish people out of Egypt. He had many interactions with Paro, and you would think, therefore, that he had interactions with Eov. And
even though Eov is sort of given or framed as someone who's not necessarily the best person in the world, or not the best guy in the world, in this story, for the most part, we know from the book of Eov, at least, that he was a good guy. He had a good heart, and he just sort of messed up big time, and therefore God punished him severely, and then ultimately he ends up turning his life back around again. But it would seem that Moshe could have had a relationship with him just because Eov was a Ben Bias in Paro's household. That's what this Gemara seems to imply. Now, if we take a step back for a second, so what we've seen so far is that there are many possibilities as to when Eov could have lived, right? There are many people who could see their lives in Eov, and there is just a lot to sort of unpack here in sort of a very general sense. So how do we sort of pin down when exactly he lived, and is it actually important or relevant for us? So take a look at source number 6. So it's a quote from Rabbi Soloveitchik where he sort of really synopsizes this, I think, very, very beautifully. He says, as follows, Rabbi Joseph Soloveitchik noted, source number 6, that in a psychological sense, all these opinions concerning Eov are accurate. Eov lived in the time of the patriarchs, the Exodus, and during the reign of Ahasuerus. He also was present during the Spanish Inquisition, the Holocaust, and at every other time of suffering. Every generation has its Eovs, people who suffer without understanding why. The universality of the book is underscored by the fact that Eov is not presented as a Jew, and there is nothing distinctly Jewish about the book. Eov symbolizes all people throughout the ages who have grappled with the question of unfair suffering. Right, so what Rabbi Soloveitchik really does very nicely for us here is saying that, listen, it could be that he existed. The Gemara seems to imply that there are plenty of different time periods that he might have existed in. It could be that many people interacted with him. But this paradigm of saying that Eov is an important person for us, not because we need to know for sure whether or not he lived, right? That's a great question. Maybe he lived, maybe he didn't live. Maybe he lived in the year 2000. Maybe he lived in the year 2500. Maybe he lived in the year 3000. It's not important. It's not relevant for us. All we need to know is that there was a man once who had this crazy thing happen to him in his life, and he suffered immensely, and then what do you know? He actually ended up having a happy ending, which we'll see in Perek Mem Beis. And Rabbi Soloveitchik says that that's how you have to look at us, ourselves, on an individual, on a national and communal level. That every single person in this world experiences tragedy and suffering, maybe hopefully not at the, God forbid, at the point that you have experienced it, but everyone suffers from tragedies and bad things in their life, and the point is you have to figure out how to deal with it. Now, what's so interesting about Sefer Eov is that Eov seems to not really deal with these things so well. In the end, again, things seem to turn around in the end, but a majority of the book is Eov struggling and saying, I don't believe in this guy anymore. Not that he doesn't believe in God, but that he struggles to say that how can there be a God who would do all these terrible things to me? I don't want to be alive anymore. And the fact that Eov is able to start at point A, where he is so happy and things are going so great for him in his life, and then go to point B, which was all these terrible things happen to him, then go to point C, which would be totally denying that there is a point of life and that there is a point of anything or serving God, and then ultimately coming all the way back around to point D, which was seeing the beauty in everything sort of once he rebuilds from the rubble that was his life. The point is that we're supposed to see that entire process, that the process of, that Eov went through of struggling so much to believe after all these terrible things happen, we have to sort of key in on that and see how that is such a valuable thing. That it's okay, it's normal to deny God. It's normal to fight with God. It's normal to struggle in life. That is what life is all about. But ultimately, the goal is to be like you have to come back from all that and to be back on top. And that's what Rabbi Soloveitchik's point is. Okay, let's go back to the text. What time is it? Hey, man. Let's go back to the text for it. Okay. We'll do just a few more psukim and then we'll stop right here for today. So let's go back to the text. So we read Pasuk Beis, Pasuk Gimel. So Vayihi Miknehu Shivas Alfei Tzon Ushloshes Alfei Gemalim V'Chamesh Meos Semed Bakar V'Chamesh Meos Asonos V'Avuda Rabba Meod V'Yihi Ha'isha Hu Gadol Mikol Bnei Kedem. Eov had lots of animals. And not only did he have lots of animals, but he had an amazing household. Not only did he have an amazing household, but he also was the richest guy in all of the East. V'halchu v'anav v'asu mishte beis ish yomo v'shalchu v'karu l'shloshes achoseihem l'achol v'lishos imahem. What did the family used to do? So he had these 7 amazing sons and 3 amazing daughters. And every single day of the week, it was convenient that he had 7 sons, because every single day of the week, one of his sons would have a giant feast. And on each one of those days, they would invite the entire rest of the family to come along, including the 3 sisters. And what would happen at the end of these of the week. Once a week, he would make them bring sacrifices, or he himself would bring sacrifices. And the reason why he did that was because he said maybe they sinned, maybe they were involved in doing terrible things, and therefore he didn't want to risk for a second that any of them would be guilty of a terrible punishment. So he would atone for all of them on a weekly basis. Now, if you zoom out of these psukim for a second, what do you see? What's so odd about these psukim? Okay, what do you mean by that?
Like, all the learning about all the animals he has and a feast that he has every day with his sons.
Okay, good. Why in the world is the author of Eov telling us all this information? It's so weird, it's so random. Okay, he had a great life. What is the author getting at over here?
Maybe that he had a great life and then he doesn't.
Okay, great.
I don't know what happens.
So, okay, good. We need to know that he has a great life. Good. But what's so interesting about this text? What's so glaring about it?
Recognizes God.
Okay, good, right? We know that...
He's saying he's not Jewish, especially. I mean, that's even more glaring.
Okay, good. We know, especially if we say that he isn't Jewish, we know that he clearly was a special person, that he believed in the God, he turned away from bad, he brought sacrifices, he tried to atone on a regular basis.
But why do we think he's not Jewish?
Why do we think he is Jewish?
Because he's such a God-fearing... He's like a person, and he like brings offerings.
Okay, so good. So
I mean, like you can be not Jewish and be God fearing. I'm not saying that you can't be, but like,
yeah.
From all of this, like, what made somebody say?
As opposed to like Bilam, who also brought sacrifices, but here you see he's genuine, as opposed to Bilam, who you see is not genuine.
Okay, good. So it seems like the main reason why you would assume that he is not Jewish is because if you look through the entire book of Eov, there are two things that are missing: the Jewish people and the Torah. Now, once are they mentioned in the entire book. And because of that, people begin to say, maybe we don't know who this guy was. Maybe he wasn't actually one of us. That's why I think where that suggestion comes from.
That makes sense.
Did it mention Hashem?
It says Hashem.
I'm just looking for it.
So, okay, good. So
perhaps my children have sinned and blasphemed Hashem in their hearts.
Right, okay. Even before that, right? In the first pasuk, God's name is mentioned. Okay. But, of course, the implication is that anyone could serve God, right? So if you assume he's not Jewish, even a non-Jewish person is encouraged to serve God. So okay, but what's the other small detail that we're all sort of missing over here? How would you describe these first five psukim?
Materialism.
Okay, maybe materialistic. I wouldn't necessarily use that word because he's not materialistic. This guy would pray once a week with an elaborate sacrificial service over here. So I think if you look at it, the way these first five psukim are phrased is that things are perfect in this guy's life. This guy has everything. He's the wealthiest guy in the entire East Coast. He has a perfect family that is, all the siblings get along, they all eat together every single day of the week, and they all have these beautiful feasts, and all the daughters are invited, even though they're not part of the brotherhood over there. Eov is worried about the atonement and the sinning of the children, so he makes sure to bring sacrifices on a weekly basis to atone for them. Things are so perfect in this guy's life, but maybe a little too perfect. Right, we've all seen horror movies, and we've all seen that at the beginning of every horror movie, there's a small town, and everything is perfect in that town. Right, everything works like clockwork, and the one streetlight in the town always works the exact right way. And there's Mr. Johnson who owns the milk shop. You know, everything is very, very perfect at the beginning of every horror movie. And then, of course, there's those behind closed doors, things sort of begin to dissolve and things sort of begin to fall apart. And so maybe we can suggest that the beginning of Sefer Eov starts in such a way to show this guy's life as being so perfect, to show that no one's life is that perfect. It's impossible. No one is that well-trained and that well-organized to have everything go so smoothly, everything working like clockwork. This guy makes sure that if there was one of his kids spoke Lashon Hara for a second, that he was bringing a sacrifice the next day. No one is that perfect. No one is like that. And if that's the case, that he was not actually this perfect, or that the author is trying to frame him in such a way that seems extra perfect, it would seem like it's almost as if we're supposed to take out of that something has to be going on behind the scenes. And perhaps even if you go back to the first pasuk, what was one of the details that the author says about him?
He was wholesome and upright.
Okay, good. So that sounds good. But what else?
He feared God.
He feared God. Why is that weird?
It seems like he's unique.
Okay, he He's unique.
As opposed to the rest of his family who are not. Which is implied by the fact that he's the one who's saying, oh, I gotta be worried about my kids.
Okay. How do we used to believe in serving God?
I would think it would be weird if it said that he loves Hashem.
Okay,
you
know, why?
You have, like, Ava and Ira.
Yeah.
And, like, you're supposed to have Ava, but, like, most people really have Ira.
Okay.
So, like,
I feel like a lot of people are described as, like, Ira, like, good people.
Okay. So
Torah. Following the Torah.
So what I would suggest, and again, feel free to push back. I hear what you're saying. But the fact that he is described as this guy that is such a servant of God, he fears God and he turns away from bad. What good does he actually do? It's unclear. Right? If you begin to read between the lines and between the words of Sefer Yov, particularly in the beginning, you'll see that at first glance, if you sort of just look from an aerial view, everything looks great, but as you begin to sort of delve deeper into his life, things are not always as perfect as they seem. And that is the messaging that we have to have as we begin to study Sefer Yov, to understand that A, who he was, where he was, when he was, it's not important, to understand that this is a guy whose story is very relevant for all of us in our own lives, and B, to understand that even as perfect as his life looked, right, sometimes we see other people's lives and we see that this girl has such a perfect life and everything seems so amazing, but if you begin to read between the lines, if you begin to dig just a little bit deeper, things are not that perfect. And in Eov's life, there was no exception to that rule. He is framed as this guy who is amazing and perfect and everything was great, but it's not like that. His life was not great. He may not have been as great as he seemed. And that's potentially why he has to get punished for things that happened in his life. And we'll see that there's a big debate. Was he deserving of punishment, or did God just randomly decide to punish him? That's what we'll have to begin with next time. I apologize for not getting through the entire parak, but I think we'll stop right here. But that's what we'll deal with next time, to understand the next few psukim that Eov is sort of confronted with, and that is in particular to say that we'll just read the English of what happens next. Pasuk 6, it happened one day, the angels came to stand before Hashem, and the Satan too came among them, and Hashem said to the Satan, from where have you come? All of a sudden the Satan comes into play. It's a little bit odd, right? This guy who we were speaking about for the past five psukim, who was this amazing guy, and now the Satan is the next character that we're introduced to, no one else. It seems like there's some sort of imbalance in Eov's life, that immediately right after we meet him, we meet the devil himself, and again, we'll have to understand exactly who the Satan is, and we'll develop that a little bit further, but there's something deeper going on here, and we'll have to sort of deal with that. But for now, we'll stop right here, and next time we'll continue from where we left off.